Morning. We'll open our meeting with a reading of the Declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophists. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of Theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the Theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of Theosophy, and the exemplification and practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity, without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. In keeping with the stated policy of the United Lodge of Theosophists, we here in Philadelphia hold two weekly meetings on Wednesday evenings from 7:30 to 8:30. We have a study class in the Ocean of Theosophy, and this coming Wednesday, we are going to continue in the study of cycles, physical and historical cycles. Also on Wednesday evening, or Wednesday afternoon evening from 5:15 to 7:15, the library is open. It's a reference library. There's a student volunteer there to help you find what reference or reading material you're interested in. Before and after the meetings, and during library hours, there is a book table in the center of the building here, upon which are displayed straight-line theosophical literature available at cost of publication and shipping. There is no profit made by the lodge for the sale of these books. In fact, all the activities here at the lodge, including the maintenance of the building, is carried on by voluntary contributions in time, service, and money. There's never any dues or collections imposed. Everything is left up to the conscience and the voluntary offerings of those who find these ideas and this work valuable. Continuing then with our activities on Sunday mornings, we have a more formal presentation of the philosophy. This month, we are looking at overall the mysteries of the animal kingdom. This morning, we have a talk on those amazing anthropoid apes. And next week, we'll have a presentation on the human-animal relationship, a relationship that goes deeper and wider than we might otherwise assume. There are a few coming events that you may want to put on your save-to-do list. May 6th, Sunday, May 6th, we are going to have our annual commemoration of the life and work of H.P. Blavatsky and her work for Theosophy. It's called White Lotus Day, and it commemorates her passing and the work she's done. Also, you may want to take note that we are going to also have our annual symposium. This year, it will be on Saturday, June 2nd, from 1 to 4:30 p.m. It is free and open to the public as usual. And this time, we're going to have a very interesting presentation, Ancient Myths for Living in Modern Times, a subject which should be very practical and illuminating for us all. We'll begin this morning an introduction to our talk on those amazing anthropoid apes with a brief reading from the Bhagavad Gita. Among thousands of mortals, a single one perhaps strives for perfection. And among those so striving, perhaps a single one knows me as I am. Earth, water, fire, air, and akasha, manas, buddhi, and ahankara is the eightfold division of my nature. It is inferior. Know that my superior nature is different and is the knower. By it, the whole universe is sustained. Learn that the whole of creation springs this too as from a womb. I am the cause, I am the production, and the dissolution of the whole universe. There is none superior to me, O conqueror of wealth, and all things hang on me as precious gems upon a string. I am the taste in water, O son of Kunti, the light in the sun and moon, the mystic syllable Om in all the Vedas, sound in space, the masculine essence in men, the sweet smell in the earth, and the brightness in the fire. In all creatures, I am the life and the power of concentration in those whose minds are on the spirit. Know me, O son of Pritha, as the eternal seed of all creatures. I am the wisdom of the wise and the strength of the strong. I am the power of the strong who in action are free from desire and longing. In all creatures, I am desire, regulated by moral fitness.
Thank you. Well, this morning's title, Those Amazing Anthropoid Apes, has been causing some chuckling and smiling for more than a few weeks among the volunteers, because it is a title that probably has not been entertained before. But it's a good one. It's a great one. So let's follow the Crosby model. Let's refresh ourselves with a view of the ideas held in the popular mind, with the notion of why all the smiling about the apes, and as we bring mind to the notions that could color our preconceptions on the topic. We'll then be ready and focused to examine these ideas in the light of the philosophy of Theosophy. H.P.B., writing in The Secret Doctrine in Volume 1, said, to this day, and again, that would be the 1800s, to this day the world is more full of ape-like men than the woods are of men like apes. And in that statement, we have a juxtaposition of the human state and the ape state. Most of us in the room date from a time where in childhood we knew that right living could be taught by care providers and parents in that monkey see, monkey do kind of phrase, where we were taught about what we wanted to follow in life and what would leadership be. Or in terms of the right living, the three little monkeys, see no evil, hear no evil, do no evil. And again, those lessons of nature in the primate form were available to us. In today's world, with the newer generations, the French animated character Curious George has a whole different lesson. And now that it's animated on PBS, little children feel a kinship, literally, with this tiny animal that is very inventive, very, very curious, and appears to have compassion or empathy, all without language. And then, of course, as Americans, we've been treated to an exploration of the animal forms at the traditional American zoo. And here in Philadelphia, we're gifted with the oldest zoo in the country, chartered in the late 1850s, right before the Civil War. The zoo itself didn't open until after the Civil War. But in the childhood, folks that are in the baby boomer stage have a very good recall of a particular ape named Massa, who lived in the Philadelphia Zoo, was born in Ghana in 1930 and lived in the zoo until 1984, and who had a lot of impact upon human beings and children who came to the edge of his cage. And across time, the experience of Massa, eye to eye, face to face, moved from an expression of sorrowful eyes on his part until finally, as a grumbly old man, one could see a degree of frustration or anger in those eyes. And children of all ages were fascinated by what appeared to be a presence in that animal form. The other thing that we share in common in the popular mind is what education has brought to us about the great apes, the anthropoid apes. Certainly, we're all aware of the theory of Darwin and how it was popularized by Spencer and based on forms and material expressions of life. What we may not be aware of, that some of the research that many of us have loved the most, that of Diane Fossey and the Gorilla Project in Rwanda, or Jane Goodall and the Chimpanzee Project in Tanzania, or the one that's closest to home would be Penny Patterson and her experiment in California with Coco the gorilla. All these women were actually graduate students, anthropologically speaking, of the Leakey family, Louis Leakey in particular. And the research is all based on applications of the Darwin theory that the human actually evolved from the form of the ape. Coco is probably the one gorilla, the one anthropoid ape that most Americans are very, very familiar with and which appears to pull on our heartstrings in many ways. All of these researchers ironically started in the 1970s. Coco has been in domestication since 1972, and Patterson's psychological theory was that if she could train a particular female starting about the year 1 year old and train that gorilla much as she would have trained a baby, a human toddler, that eventually she could produce an experiment in which that female at maturity, having her own babies, might be able to impart to her babies what the human had imparted to the gorilla. So Coco was trained in American Sign Language from 1 year old on. She has lived with a variety of mates. Many of us are very familiar with Allpaw, her kitten companion that she had for a number of years. She has been mated in California a couple of times. Nadume was the first male brought to Coco, and he also was taught sign language. The experiment going to be, could they communicate together? He has since passed on. She now lives with a male named Michael, and apparently is barren. There have been no infants produced, so the ultimate aspect of the experiment has not been finished. But those of us that have recently seen clips of Mr. Rogers interacting with Coco know that she does indeed use sign language. There are claims in the literature of Dr. Patterson that Coco understands spoken English, that she does express empathy, that she can create word sequences and has, in fact, begun to use reading cards the same way a small child might be taught to decode words. The experiment has not been replicated by anyone else, much like Harlow's rhesus monkey experiments. And in fact, Dr. Patterson now writes that if she were to do it all over again, she would not. That this research is controversial and should not be repeated. Most of Coco.org, if you would go to that website, they're now fundraising, attempting to purchase a wildlife sanctuary on the island of Maui so they can get her out of a double-wide trailer and a small enclosure into a much larger scenario so that she could at last live a natural life. So how is it that we seem to be hardwired to react to the infant face of a chimp or an orangutan or a gorilla? There's something about these infant animals that are very, very akin to human infants. And we're very aware that there seems to be an instinctive sense in the human, maybe an intuitive sense, that there is a great oneness between these amazing apes and us. If you look at the other aspect of that, and you go into an internet search on this subject matter, you will realize that in the popular mind, the anthropoid apes include the gorilla, the chimpanzees, the orangutan, and to a lesser degree, some of the gibbons of the Pacific Islands. They share with the human form certain things like highly developed brains and elongated arms. They can be bipedal, but they don't have to be. Their hands work somewhat like ours, the juxtaposable thumb that's so much part of our kingdom is not fully available to them. But it's in the faces and the eyes more than anything else where we think we sense something in those eyes, the same way as when we look eye to eye to a human, we sense, we even say commonly, the windows are the eyes of the soul, that there's something there. Extinction is certainly another major problem. In the popular mind, if you were to talk to many people, they would express concern about the gorillas in the lowlands. They're not fully arboreal, and therefore they need their lowlands, but both the lowlands and the rainforests are disappearing. About a third of the natural-born apes have been killed off since 1990 from the Ebola virus. And hunting, poaching, human warfare have all impacted on the lifestyle of these animals in the wild. So those are some of the common things that we seem to share, and perhaps underscoring a lot of the popular thought is the Darwinian theory of evolution. So if we are to bring the light of theosophy to this subject matter about these amazing creatures and why the oneness between man and ape, we see that there's a very different point of view about what evolution is and what is the nature of the relationship between man and ape. Religiously, especially in the Western world, we're told that man sprung from one pair, from a uniquely created pair, and that all human beings are from that source. Until you look into the Old Testament more specifically, and you see allusions to Adam and Eve and Cain and Abel and how they moved out and married with other groups nearby. And all of a sudden you begin to think, wait a minute, what happened to the unique religious teaching about only one pair, only one source? From the scientific point of view, based on physicality and what can be measured and quantified and held in experimentation and duplicated, philosophy of theosophy would say, wait a second, man never was not. The form that we're currently using may be relatively recent, very familiar to us and something we can identify with, but in terms of spirit and mind, what is human is that perception, that ability to cognate far above and beyond what the senses give, and that spirit precedes all form. Spirit and mind precede matter. And in view of that teaching, that spirit is first descending into matter and then moving through the various forms of matter to ascend again back to a spiritual state, that ever-becoming moves through a whole series of forms from the most ethereal we could possibly imagine, gradually to a pivotal point of the most material in which we now operate, and that this life force, if you will, of the human variety comes forth in seven different places around the globe, and that this sevening upon sevening is potentially what is very, very important. So around 1893, when Blavatsky and Judge were first teaching theosophy here in the late 1800s, there was social Darwinism and applications of the survival of the fittest that accompanied the genocide of the American native. It accompanied the enslavement of Americans of African descent. It was thinking that was then applied to manifest destiny and the foreign policy in the Pacific with the Asians. And that upset the religious groups. But in terms of the theosophical groups, seekers of truth that were trying to investigate, it was not an upsetment because it was rejected. If spirit is so vital to the human state, if we are soul moving and experiencing in the human form, in that soul, in that oneness, is total spiritual equality and the potential of tremendous power, overarching, overriding everything that we can see expressed on the physical plane. And as was said, that early stage of experience on this globe, in the first rounds, as it was said, life was extremely ethereal. Life force moved without the bounds and the constrictions that we now have in our physical state. And so during those early rounds, when there was a mindless, oneness, spiritual, ethereal existence, there was no barrier for conceptions. And so what the philosophy has stated, what the ancient teachings have been across time, is that there were interbreeding by soul moving through forms that were destined eventually to be fully human, but the interbreeding was done at a point where it was done with a form that was a tentative use of spirit, but not meant to be a permanent use of spirit. So early on, there was this mindless, innocent interbreeding of forms in which what would have been a spiritual, fully blown human soul entity today was trapped in a different lane of expression, if you will, in a lesser form, a more limited form. So that's the one point of source, that the human is actually the source or the origin of the anthropoid apes. A certain number of the egos, a certain number of those souls that were trapped in those forms of the anthropoid apes, it is said, according to ancient teachings across time and place, that they will exist in those forms as a semi kind of consciousness, as a potential fully cognizant human soul. They will remain in those forms until the ape forms will gradually die out. And that's an interesting statement for those in the popular culture who are so worried about the extinction of the ape forms. The ancient scriptures agree that this is a natural occurrence that will happen, and that eventually, although there's been a door closed to most of the life force or spirit that we see in the array of the mineral and the vegetable and the lower animal kingdoms, there is a delayed race effect in that some of the potential egos that have been trapped in these ape forms will still be able to be rewarded for their karmic weight and will gradually, eventually come into the human kingdom. And that's just a statement that's kind of floated out there that we would imagine would take eons, but apparently within this Manvantara, within this period of expression of deity, that's still a possibility. The monkeys, the ones with the tails, that run on all fours, that are not these amazing apes, they're not part of that cycle. And so there's other quotes. You can do two lines of study for yourself to look at this. Certainly the chapter in the ocean by William Q. Judge is a very succinct statement of all this, but you can also go through the secret doctrine and learn some other interesting things, where the tendencies, if among the Atlanteans, fully minded, moral thinking entities, full humans, in their period of time, some of the Atlanteans actually made it with these lesser, smaller, mindless apes, if you will. And so there's that second, very deliberate, very karmic potential activity in the fourth round, where more anthropoids were created. And again, it was a human decision at that point to intermate and produce this other form. And there too, there are additional souls trapped in that halfway state between animal and man. But as HPB wrote in the Secret Doctrine, that initial quote that was used, the world is more full of ape-like men than the woods are of men like apes. That's still a tickle. You know, how many human beings do we see living very reflexively on the basis of their physical senses, on the basis of their desires, on the basis of habitual sense experience, and how many times are we ourselves tempted in a volatile scenario or a crisis to revert to a reflexive reaction to something that's around us, but not something that we take the time to meditate on or contemplate or to truly observe it, to weigh it on the basis of right living and good morality. So that's it for the amazing anthropoid apes. They are definitely related in many ways to the human kingdom. But unlike Wikipedia, if you want to chuckle later today, actually it's not quite a chuckle, I guess. If you go to anthropoid apes on Wikipedia, which is a suspect source anyway, they go through the monkey kingdoms, and then they explain the anthropoid apes, and listed as an anthropoid ape is human being. And when you look at that entry, they have photographs of a man and a woman from the South Pacific Islands, probably Indonesia, Sumatra, and they're listing this twosome as apes. And therefore, the source is the human being is merely an animal and is limited by the conditioned experience of the animal. And again, theosophically, if you come to the subject matter, what we sense about each other, both likenesses and differences among and between ourselves and with the anthropoid apes, that is the tip of the iceberg. That's the icing on the cake, so to speak. But at heart, in spirit, in that indwelling oneness, in the voice of Krishna that was read initially, there is a highest potential we can imagine, a highest potential for what it means to be soul using a physical form. Far, far more than what Wikipedia and the popular notions would have you believe of evolution. So hopefully you came with your own ideas on the subject matter. There's a hand way in the back.
Two questions. One, are bonobos included in the great apes?
I did not encounter that term at all. What's a bonobo?
B-O-N-O-B-O. They're a type of a chimp.
Similar to a chimp.
They're similar to a chimp. They were not listed in what I saw.
Okay.
Let's see. If they have highly developed brains, elongated arms, if they can walk upright and be bipedal, if they have hands, although the juxtaposal thumb is not fully functioning, if they have limited use of tools, problem solving, and family structure, they probably are. There's a whole subset of gorillas, a whole subset, and there's a subset of chimpanzees. So I would guess the answer is yes, but that's a guess. Yeah.
And the second question is, so when we're looking at mind in these great apes then, they're not fully lit, but then they're partially, can we say?
Partially lit might be a really good term. Theosophically, the ancient scriptures, when you line them up, the summary in the SD and in Isis both is that about 18 million years ago, forms were ready, mind was ready, spirit was ready, and what we have is a full lighting up, so to speak, in the human kingdom. And so that would be a full potential expression where a soul is born into a human body and at birth has a full potential to become aware of I am that I am, that metacognition, the ability to think about what we're doing is there, the full development of language, our vocal cords are such that we can sustain really a metaphysical process. If you think about it, we have the ability to perceive, to know that we're perceiving, the ability to create ideas, and then take those ideas and either act on them through word or through action or in written form. And the half-lit example, and I guess why Coco is so appealing at so many different levels, is that you see the halfness of the experience, where as an adult female, she really hasn't progressed much beyond a human baby of, say, 2 or 3 years old. Philosophically, it's taught that a human child, until about the age of 7, functions very, very much, very simply, almost on an animal level, while the brain is developing and the body is developing and the child is beginning to be able to come into their own as thinkers. The age of, quote, early age of moral consciousness of ethical living is about 7 years old. And that's substantiated in most of the world religions and how they develop their religious education. Coco is a tough case because Penny Patterson has lived with this animal in almost a mother-child relationship. And when Coco gets excited and uses American Sign Language, many professional sign language interpreters can't read what she's saying. But Penny Patterson can. So it's akin to those very early stages where a mother may know what the baby is needing or thinking almost intuitively. There's a direct perception available. The scenario with Coco and her kitten, she had a tailless kitten that Patterson introduced because Coco was so very lonely. And as a young gorilla, that gregarious need was not being fulfilled by being surrounded by graduate students in psychology. So they got the kitten. Unfortunately, the kitten got out of the trailer and was killed, and Coco witnessed the death. She was run over. And that's the big empathy break where the half-lit phenomenon showed up, in that Coco had enough sign language that she signed, all ball gone, Coco sad, all ball gone. And there's a children's book that they did with photographs of this gorilla expressing what was humanized by her caretakers as being a full expression of empathy, and a sense of, I'm feeling this. Well, human children can do this. A 2-year-old, a 3-year-old, a 4-year-old, they know what they're feeling and they can express it, but they may still be very reactionary based on desire and activity and the need to control their environment, almost narcissistic to a point. So there's a long, windy interpretation of half-lit. Goodall and Fossey, the research done in the natural settings, it does not seem to be a communication between generations in the same way that they hoped that Coco could do it or we can do it. It really is monkey see, monkey do. The chimpanzee learns by watching the mother to do X, Y, and Z in the natural environment. Yeah.
So theosophy would explain that the anthropoid apes, their amazing qualities are due to the fact that because of what happened during Atlantis, there's a human ego trapped in an animal form as the result of this unnatural procreation.
Right.
So one of the other very strong arguments by the Darwinists that humanity has come from the apes is they'll look at the fossil remains, a very primitive snake like forms or monkey like forms, for example, in Africa, or we'll look at Neanderthal man and some common features there. What does theosophy say are the sources of these primal human animal like forms? If they haven't come from the ape, what are they from?
The philosophy says that there's a gradual evolution or emanation or coming forth from a divine entity, not even an entity, an absolute force, a deific principle, if you will. And that very gradually there's a gradual involvement of spirit from this source through more and more ethereal levels of or planes of substance until finally deeply enmeshed in the physicality of expression or manifestation, we get to where we are now. It is said that when fossils are being found, what's actually happening is that each of these rounds, if you will, as they developed and as they progressed through various levels of substance of matter, some of the impress of the ethereal earlier forms was trapped in that mineralization. So that what happens is the archaeologists are actually digging up fossilized impress in substance from a much, much earlier point in time, an ethereal point of development in what's called, say, the first rounds and races. So as they're finding these things trapped as impressions in substance, they're thinking that this is within the last 18 million years and that there's a cause and effect. If these early impress in rocks appear to be like humans, then certainly that must be where we came from. They're not using a premise of spirit before substance, of ethereal existence before physicality. If you want to look into this a little bit, in the first volume of The Secret Doctrine, around page 183, there is a section called Man, the Oldest Son of the Earth, and there are descriptors of the first round and the first race of being very, very lunial, ethereal, or non-intelligent, but super spiritual, and that they are encased in an ethereal, sexless, animal and vegetable kind of experience, and that first coming forth from the deific essence. And then in the second round, there's a different degree of a little more substantiation of the human. It's gigantic, it's ethereal, growing a little bit more condensed and a little bit firmer, but still not fully intelligent at that point in time, but very, very spiritual, very intuitive. And then in the third round is when there's a slightly more substantial form being used. In this state would be kind of like a giant ape. And we have some of those legends even now in the Pacific Northwest and throughout Asia of sightings, legends and myths and modern explorers trying to find the Yeti or Sasquatch or these other universal legends of a man ape in a huge form operating even until today. So it's an interest. The fossils are a very interesting conundrum. One of the biggest puzzles, I guess, for a student of theosophy and otherwise, is that the Leakey family, working in the Olduvai Gorge in southeastern Africa, came up with a very tiny little fossil, an anthropoid. They've named her Eve. And when they tested for DNA in that little remainder, what they did find that is on the physical plane, the DNA in that particular fossilized entity exists in every single woman anywhere on the face of the planet today. So we have, in essence, a physical form, a whole series of them that we as human spirit have used and discarded. As mind beings in the fourth race with the Atlanteans, there was this crime against nature, literally the interbreeding. And then we have the true oneness, not in the physical form, but truly in the spirit, in the heart, in the soul, in the compassion, in the intuitive nature.
Just a follow-up to that fine explanation. We recall the secret doctrine explains that although the Atlanteans at their height of development were giants physically and intellectually compared to us, that those forms did degenerate over time.
Mm-hmm.
And that the final remnants of that, those degraded remnants of the Atlanteans were those very primitive anthropomorphized human ape forms we see, and also the Neolithic mm-hmm. forms that we see in Europe. So naturally, the DNA would be the same, because every human being alive today is ancestors were from those physical Atlanteans.
So it makes perfect sense. But there is this wonderful study where there's literally crossover. There's that ethereal that was trapped as an impress in the development of the mineral stage. And again, it points out if the premise is not correct, then, boy, the conclusions drawn can be way off base. Yes,
sir? We hear in here that we've been here for 18 million years.
Yeah.
So what are you talking about with fossils? Because how far back do they go? They go back 1,000 years, 100,000 years,
mm-hmm.
you know, and because the premise is wrong. They're starting from this particular, but they don't see the larger picture, which theosophy and which you were talking about this morning.
Yeah. And you know, there's so many different ways to come at this study. If you've been raised in a particular religion or a very scientific household or a very philosophical household, wherever you start, you can gradually begin to develop by looking at myths from all over the world, by looking at legends and hieroglyphs and archaeology, the oral traditions that are so ancient on the continent of Africa, the stone remnants of traditions in South America. You can go through the very ancient written texts in Asia, and among these very, very ancient peoples, you can find the elements of the oneness of life, the need for ethical right living, and truly the invitation and the challenge to lead life in a way that there's a selfless effort to help and assist everyone else. And that includes everyone: mineral, vegetable, animal, great apes, human beings, everybody. Because it's all, life is all one, just reflected differently under those different conditions. Yeah.
We were wondering if there are any scientists of note or that are on board with the theosophical teachings of the, you know, the ape actually descending from the man, or if they're still all locked into man descended from apes?
The one crossover, and this is not exact, that came up, and it came up last Sunday, I think, also, is that maybe two crossovers. The fact that Patterson, Dr. Patterson, who's working with Coco, is so adamant that this experiment is unnatural and should not be done. Her life experience of living with Coco and seeing the frustration as Coco was educated, as more of her talents were brought out from within, Patterson is more and more aware of that half-lit frustration. And anybody that visited Massa at the Philadelphia Zoo across years, the experience of watching Massa from like 1950 to 1984 and seeing the change in the eyes and the body language was heart-wrenching. And all of the graduate students that they hired from Penn to come live in the cages with the baby chimps and the baby orangutans and the baby gorillas, all of them came away with a sense of there's something we don't know here. So that's also the case. But one of the crossovers in terms of pure theosophy would be Maslow. Remember last week, somebody referred to the rhesus monkey experiment by Dr. Harlow. And it was extremely controversial. He did win a prize from the American Psychological Association. But the scientists at MIT in the experimental psych department were up in arms over how this whole thing was done. When the rhesus monkeys were tested in a variety of motherless scenarios, one of the graduate students was a guy named Abraham Maslow. And his entire life work, more akin to philosophy and theosophy, than was to take what he noted in that laboratory with Harlow and move it into the human kingdom. And he paralleled, as well as a psychologist named James, the theosophical teachings of what it would be to be a self-actualizing human being. But that's the only one I know of. Does anybody know of another scientist who would have studied this stuff? Yeah.
Well, I don't know of any particular scientist, but I do know in the whole creation versus evolutionary controversy that there are scientists in favor of the creation story who have gathered a lot of evidence that seems to be outside the normal theory as to disprove it, contradictions. Not that they come up with a scientific theory or explanation of their own, other than, well, there had to be some outside being created, but their accumulated evidence does challenge or raise questions about the accepted scientific theory, and that's why there's that controversy.
The other name along the same lines of the controversy, the late Stephen Hawking, you can see a series of shows called Genius, and in that series there's a group of graduate students, different in every sequence, conducting experiments that Hawking supposedly developed for them. And when you watch this scientific team go through physics applications to solve problems and hear what they're thinking about in terms of quantum physics and something called multiple worlds, which almost sounds like the sheaths of the soul or the seven planes of experience that theosophy teaches, they're getting really, really close in saying, wait a minute, what's going on here? Was there a creative Big Bang? Is there an evolutionary situation. If it is evolutionary, where's the source of genius? So that would be one line of investigation, but they're not focused on apes. They're doing it from quantum physics. Yeah.
Perhaps the larger impact of this consideration is to challenge the prevalent idea that the human being has descended from the ape, or is a animal in essence. That has unbelievable ramifications in every aspect of our life, and the ape is just one means of trying to prove it.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess ultimately the theosophical perspective is we are not an animal, either in form or in mind. We are a completely separate kingdom of nature.
And how important is that? When we heard the reading of the Declaration this morning, those of us who have been around for a while, you know, kind of roll with the wording, but if you stop and think, the true nature of self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. If we take a human child, we could insidiously create the mind state of an anthropoid ape in that child. If that child is raised and trained and conditioned, you are a dope. You're a mindless, sniveling little earthworm, and you're not worth much. If you raise that child thinking, I'm a sinful creation, and I have no willpower, I have no ability to think and to choose and to create, if you convince a little child that, congratulations, baby, you're living in a predestined life and you can rule the world and whatever you want can be yours. Just follow your desires. The crippling effects of that conditioned thinking is beyond belief, and it affects all avenues of nature for life and for lives. And on the opposite end of the spectrum, if a child is raised with this information of, I am soul, I am an emanation or a ray of divinity, I can use my mind in terms of thinking from premise to conclusion in a kindly way, I can create and endeavor and support all other life forms to be all they can be. I can help my fellow man, and I should, because we are at one. We're all in this together. We're all evolving spiritually. The child raised with that knowledge has an intuitive sense of universal brotherhood and cannot do evil, but can only choose wisely to be sure that that brotherhood and that energy-giving life is available to each and all. So we can cripple ourselves by the ideas we hold. We can set ourselves free by the ideas that we hold. And unfortunately, if we act with the mindlessness or the half-wittedness that we see in the anthropoid ape, we can be used and manipulated as tools against the welfare of one and all. Our time's over, but Wednesday the building will open at 5:15. The library will be available. This information is available to everyone. And Wednesday night, the class will start promptly at 7:30, and it's sure to be a good one. Have a great day.